We got lost in the mix.
I don't know what happened with the app. I think maybe because it was our first recording or something, but it cut us off at a certain point because it said you're done recording and whatnot. So I hope you can use this audio and maybe splice it in on what we were just doing. Or if not, you can call me back and we can try to do that. What do you think?
Yeah, either one. What I can do is I can put up what we recorded this morning, the little spot, and maybe that would give the people the teaser of saying, hey, now I want to go over to Hugo's podcast and check out the rest of the conversation. Because terrific. there is a way to do it, but I'm not quite sure. I did a record with friends back a while ago with Medicine Remixed, and they told me that they could send me the audio if I wanted to play it on my podcast. But I said, no, that's okay. Just play it on yours, and we'll
take it from there. Okay, yeah. I want to get back to the conversation because just as before we got cut off, we were talking about the overall agenda for the show. But I wanted to tell you what resonates to me about when I hear you, and the reason, because you had talked about having gone through some depression a few months back and sharing that on the show, and that you weren't sure if people wanted to hear that. But I'm realizing that people do. I think that we are living in a time where, because you were talking about, you know, the influence of how we're changing and how social media is moving us along and how technology is changing the basics of human nature in a lot of ways. But all of that, it's like drinking out of a fountain hose. And I find that people maybe don't deal with it as well as they could. We already have challenges and social media just compounds that. And so to hear somebody who says, I am hurting and I am going through the process of this hurt, and my outlet is this audio channel and so that other people know what I'm going through, what's going through my mind, how I'm coping with it. I think there's a lot of power to that, Patrick. And that's part of the reason why when you spoke about that on your show, and it wasn't all pretty. It wasn't some of those things that you want to hear. And also, like you said, you're in like a dream. So you're trying to describe what you're going through, and you're hoping that it resonates out there in the ether. But you never really know. But I can tell you that it does, and it means a heck of a lot to me. And I'm sure from the feedback that you get from the calls that you get that it's resonating with others. So I just wanted to let you know that it is appreciated. And I don't know that you set out to do that, but it was a good turn that you took, or at least you, since you were honest with yourself, you allowed yourself to take that turn, and that has a lot of value.
Thank you. And, you know, I really appreciate those kind words, and I know that words mean a lot to you. You know, I listened to your podcast and you were saying how words mean things, and they really do. And I don't know what it was. It was almost a year ago when I was doing the podcast that something came out to me. I said to my wife, I said, you know what? I think I'm going to share with my listeners that I'm an alcoholic, that I'm a recovering alcoholic, because I never tell anybody that. I hold it close to my chest. I don't talk about it. And it happened to be, I had 2 years, 2 months, and 22 days. And I liked the way it looked. I liked the 2222. And so I was like, what a perfect day for me to just kind of come out and say to my listeners that I am a recovering alcoholic. And it felt so freeing. And so I kind of think I grabbed on that feeling of freedom of the next step to say, you know what, the next thing I'm going to do is I think I'm going to let my listeners know that I'm bipolar. And I've been dealing with bipolar for almost 30 years now or more. And once I did, I felt free, but yet I felt very vulnerable. I felt like, oh no, I can't believe it, because I don't want anybody to know, really. I have that bit of shame, that stigma that still hangs around mental health, but I feel like, you know what, if there's stars and other people out there that can share it and people get value out of that, maybe one person can get a little value out of me, because they can listen and say, he doesn't sound like he's that. And it's like, yeah, because that's the face of mental health. You know, that is what it is.
Do you feel that part of the equation too is that you've reached a point, without revealing your age, not that I think you would care, but that you've reached a point maturity wise where you feel that I care less about what people think, and so yes. I'm more financially, you know, I guess what I mean is this. I know that for me, I'm an independent contractor. I work on my own. I've stopped being a corporate person several years ago. And so now that I have this freedom to talk, I can be more honest with myself and with my listeners about what's going on in my life. But it's because I have a good financial footing that I feel that even if somebody slings something at me because they don't like me, I am not risking getting fired from somewhere. Right. You know what I mean? So yeah. do you feel that that's a component of it? Is that the fact that you've reached an age or a financial security or combination of both where you feel that, okay, now I can speak because I have the license of being a full-grown adult to be able to do so?
I think you really hit a lot of points right on the head. And I have no problem telling my age. I'm 48 years old. And it's taken me this long to finally really come to grips. And I think that the age has a lot to do with it. Here, a prime example. I never would really leave the house unless my hair had to be a certain way. I had to be wearing a certain thing. Now that I'm almost 50, I'll say to my wife, I'm like, I'm just running to the store. And I never was that guy. I never would. Now I do. So I think, yeah, age has something to do with it. And I think that once I started hearing a lot of prominent people and names coming out and the response that they would get, I'm like, well, how come when I tell people, they seem to recoil and they pull back and they're like, oh, well, geez, I don't know if I can talk about bipolar. But if somebody like Catherine Zeta-Jones comes out, everybody's like, oh my God, she's so brave to share that. And I'm like, I want to be that way. I want to be brave to share my story and tell people, because it is quite a story. And I've had a lot of ups and downs with this disease that I've been dealing with. And for years, I never really wanted to think of it as a disease. I would fight with my doctors about it. And they'd say, this is no different than diabetes. And I'm like, bullshit, it's a lot different. You know, if the diabetic doesn't take his insulin, he could die. And they're like, yeah, but if you don't take care of yourself, eventually you could as well. And so it was always a struggle for me to think of it as a disease, I guess. And so once I finally realized, I'm not going to be cured from this. This is something I'm always dealing with. I might as well own it and share it and talk about it. And it makes me feel a lot freer.
Let me shift gears real quick. You talked about history a little bit ago. And again, I guess it's one of those things where I feel like we're going to talk about things that we have in common. And I'm hoping eventually we'll find something where we'll disagree to spice things up. But when it comes to history, I have always been a fan of history. And I use that term, fan of history. That's not my original thought. That's from one of my favorite podcasters, Dan Carlin. He has a show called Hardcore History. And he describes himself as not as a historian, but a fan of history. And he does these deep dives into very interesting subjects. And I think part of the reason why I have enjoyed learning history, especially from a guy like that, is that it puts my world in a much greater context. When I look at the news, there's a lot of awful things going on in the world. But when we contrast that with how things have been in the past, and we're not talking in the last 500, 300 years, we're talking about thousands of years ago, how brutal we were with one another, truly, in the hundreds of thousands of the millions. When you look at some of the things that are happening on today, yes, they're terrible, but to me, it feels like the human condition over time, over a long time, has gotten better. We just have these big microphones that is called the internet, where you can broadcast a lot of that to the world, but it seems like it's a lot worse than it is. But I like the feeling of having history teach me that we're doing better glacially, maybe, but it is the human condition is getting better. The advancements that we had that we've had over the years are making our globe better than it could be, or life is not as harsh as it has been. So that is how I take history. You said a bit ago that you were a fan of it yourself, and that you kind of that you sought it out. Tell me a little bit about how you enjoy it.
Yeah, I like to look back at the people and realize they were real, like you said, that they had the trials and tribulations that they went through. But I just like to learn from it. I think that getting gray matter on your brain is just like going to the gym and working out. And so even if it seems like a useless information at the time, I'm gaining something from it. And so I get that with history. I like to think of, like right now as we're talking, I can't imagine what it would be like to even go back 150 years and explain to somebody, hey, in 150 years, I'm going to have a device where I can, and just to see their expression, because in my mind, I think, okay, well, what will it be like in another 150 years when they talk about me?
Sure.
They'll be like, well, he was using this type. And they're like, what? He actually, they held on to phones. There wasn't an implant.
Right.
They weren't. And it's like, no, implants didn't come until 2020 or something like that. And so I always like to think of how it was, how it will be, how people would react to it. How, you know, like the other day, you know how you can, when you get the taco mix, they come, the pre-mix, you get the hard shells and the soft shells and you can get the little thing. And I'm like, it's in a little silver bag. And I'm like, can you imagine just talking to somebody even 50 years ago and say, I can give you hard tortillas and this, and they would look at you like you're crazy. And so I like that about history right now. Whenever I think about things, that could happen too, you know? Oh. And I don't know if that really makes sense of history wise, but it's more like the futurist. I like to think about both at the same time of the what ifs and how people would react to it.
Oh, it you know, I think we all approach it from a different place, but at the same time, it's enjoyable. It's fun. It gives us a grander point of view. I mean, I had a similar thought when it came to tortilla chips. I was making some chili for the family. And if you go to my Instagram, you'll see the entire process because I like to go step by step and step how I make my chili. But anyways, I was making chili and at the very last minute, I thought, oh, you know what? I need tortilla chips to go with this whole thing. So I ran down a block and a half away and bought for $1.29 a whole bag of tortilla chips. And on my way on the drive back home from that, I thought, you know, it would have taken our ancestors an entire season to grow the corn, to pick the corn, to process the corn, to make the tortillas, to then eventually make the chips. And it was an entire process, and it depended on the weather. It depended on, you know, whether you had locusts out there attacking your crops and give a few degrees here and there of bad climate, and maybe they starve for a year. But here I am. At any given point in time, at any day, I can just run down to the store and get myself some chips. That's what I mean as far as the human condition has gotten to be so simple in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people hurting in the world, but there's a lot of advancements that we've made too.
Yeah. See, and what you just said, that's exactly the type of things I'll think all the time. And I'll say that stuff to my wife and she'll just kind of look at me and with a blank look and what you just said, I was like totally interested and going, yeah, they have to make the corn. They have to smash the corn. They have to grow it. And all that stuff that's exactly how I think. And you're right. The human condition, but you know, it's different though too, because not that there wasn't drugs around, but I think our biggest problem, one of the problems is our opioid crisis. Now granted drugs, you know, back 1,000 years ago, ancients knew about it, but I think that our downfall is going to be that because we're a lot of, well, and zombies. We're walking around with our cell phones in our face and not talking to one another. And you and I are a little bit older. We're still probably the type of people that hold the door for people, say hello to them, look at them. I don't talk on my phone out in public. Like if I put my phone in my pocket and I'm in Walmart and it rings, I don't answer it. I can wait that 2 minutes until I'm out in my car and answer it. It's just because I'm old school. I grew up with a landline and stuff. And I don't have a problem with people using their phones out in public. That's what they're for. But I myself, I don't know. And so I'll take this technology and embrace it. But in that same sense, I push against it because I'm like, we're just walking around zombies and we don't talk to one another anymore.
Well, and on that point, I am a big fan. And I did a show on this about George Orwell's 1984. And it is one of my favorite books, if not my favorite book. And in it, he talks about, you know, talk about a futurist, but he talks about, you know, these telescreens that where people could, you know, go to during certain points of the day to have these images thrown out to them. And they would have these 5 minutes of hate where they would just yell at the screen and say how terrible things were. And this is our enemy. And sometimes people forgot, was this our enemy this week or was he our friend last week? And they couldn't make sense of it. Orwell talks about this thing called newspeak, where all of the words were truncated so that, you know, if you used to say a long sentence, now you didn't have to. You could just, shorten the word and it would have all of this meaning. But the whole point is, shorter words or limit vocabulary. And there's all sorts of things thrown in there. And in a lot of ways, I feel that we have become very Orwellian in the way that we go about things. I mean, I worry about this when it comes to our family. We'll come home in within 20 minutes if I let them. The kids will go to their phones, to their screens, and they will just disconnect from us and connect into the internet. And I'm mindful of that to the point where we've had to make agreements in the house of there are places where the phone doesn't go. There are times when, no, there is no internet for you. And that not everything has to be shared. And trust me, I put a lot of stuff out there. I mean, the name of my show is called Hugo's Post because it's based on all of the stuff that I do that I like to share. But when it comes to the kids, I would at least like to give them until the time they become legal and of age, the opportunity to just be kids in a way to certainly, well, as much as I can, or mirror as close as I was a kid when I wasn't connected to everything.
Yeah, yeah. And my kids aren't where I have to tell them they can't be on their phone. Mine are grown. Mine are 23, and my oldest will be 32 in December. And I can't imagine having younger ones, though, because I myself can disconnect sometimes with my wife and don't even mean to when I'll get on the phone and I'll be doing something and she'll talk. All of a sudden I'll look and I'll be like, huh, what was that? And I'm like, oh, I can't imagine having little ones right now and trying to police their screen time. That's got to be a lot to handle, I'm sure.
It's a brave new world for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
You know, it's conversations that a lot of parents, and you're right. I mean, I'm about 10 years your junior. A lot of parents of my age are dealing with now is this whole concept of technology and how it's affecting the kids. But I will say that it's affecting the adults just as much. I mean, yeah. I know how attached to it. And again, all technologies are both a blessing and a curse. The reason why I have the opportunity to talk to you today is because of the technology.
Yeah. And so, that is amazing to me. That part alone, if that's the thing too, back on like talking future talk or something. I mean, what we're using right now, I'm using an iPhone. I'm sure you're probably using some type of smartphone. There's like 1,000 more times power in these phones that we're using than what sent up the Apollo mission that sent our guys to the moon. And that to me is amazing. That is just amazing that I have now the ability to of having every bit of information that I'll ever need right at my fingertips. And that is, it blows my mind away still to this day sometimes to where I can just ask a computer to answer something. And that back just 20 years ago or 15 years ago was science fiction. And so we're living in a science fiction type world, I feel, because science fiction becomes science fact. The Star Trek Next Generation, they had tablets. And I remember thinking, oh, wouldn't that be cool?
Right.
And now I have one. And I just don't even really think about it. Every once in a while, it will hit me, though, where I'm like, wow, we've come far. Because in my lifetime alone, I remember 8-track cassettes. It's pretty amazing. I think it is amazing how far we've come. But it is also, it's a cursing and a blessing, like you said, both.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the people that send you messages.
Yes.
Because it seemed to me, as I was looking through your show history, and again, you're prolific. You basically record every day or if not every other day?
Actually, what I used to every day, but now I'm Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays.
Okay. Well, at least from the beginning shows, you had people calling into you or reaching out to you in one way, shape, or form fairly right away.
Right.
Do you find that that's because you were an early adopter of the app or was that or were you... Where were you that people were just wanted to reach out?
Yeah, when I first started, I had a lot of people call me and saying, your podcast is like no other podcast I ever heard. And when Anchor first came out, it was called Anchor.fm, Radio Reinvented. So in my mind, Hugo, since being like an old school radio guy in WKRP in Cincinnati, I didn't know I was making a podcast. I thought I was making, at the time, you could only do 5-minute segments. And then it would dissolve into the ether. And the next day you would do a 5-minute segment and you could do as many as you wanted, but you could only record 5 minutes at a time.
Oh, interesting.
And yeah, so I would come out I numerous times in a day. I'd be sitting talking to my wife and all of a sudden I'd be like, oh, I got something to say on Anchor FM. So I'll be right back. And I'd run into what I call my recording studio, which is just the laundry room. and speak into the phone whatever was on my mind right at the minute. And next thing you know, I'd be getting a bunch of people listening, a bunch of people calling back and saying, your pod or your show is like no other show. It feels like an old radio show. It feels like this. It feels like that. And so right out of the gate, I got lucky and was able to get onto the Anchor leaderboard at a very beginning stage. And months ago, I was featured by Anchor on their homepage. And so, and that helped me a lot. And I don't know. I think because I didn't know what I was doing. And then when version 3 came out and they said it's going to be podcast, I felt defeated, Hugo. I felt like, oh, shit, I'm not a podcaster. I'm no Joe Rogan. I'm no guy like that. I'm not going to be able to do this. Right. And I said, I'm just going to continue to do what I was doing. And that's what I did. And then when the monetization came out, you had to dump all your music if you wanted to join the monetization. Well, I'm a guy that, hey, if something new comes out, I'm not going to put my heels in the ground and be like, I want the old Facebook back. You remember when people would bitch about that?
Oh, yeah. I was there, and I'd you know, just keep on moving, you know?
Yeah, and so I said with this with Anchor, I'm like, why would I not try the monetization? People are listening to me for more than just this Apple iTunes, I hope. So I went through, got rid of all my music, and the show is where it is. It's always evolving. It's always changing to me. I might have the same type format, but it is still always kind of changing and evolving. And I'm always trying to experiment and do a little different things. But yeah, I've met people from Australia to Japan to Ireland through this app. And it's been wonderful. And it's because of technology.
You know, I've always appreciated the fact that you paint a picture right from the get-go, or at least in the latter episodes, or at least since I've started listening to you, that you kind of always begin the shows more often than not with telling us what the weather's like, what the temperature's going to be like. It puts you in a place, and I've always appreciated that in the background, several of the times, if I'm remembering correctly, there's a lot of the ambient noise that's going on around it, and that it brings to me, it brings you into the show. So if I've always appreciated that, I think that's that in the name. I think it's very evocative of the fact that we do live on a planet, and it's the only one that we know of that can host life the way that we know it. And we need to be mindful of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that helped my podcast too, because of the name, the unique name, and that we live on a planet is something I've said for years. I'd say to my wife, I'm like, sometimes I just want to go up and grab somebody and shake them and say, do you realize we live on a planet? Because of course we do. But a lot of times, like you said, that is pretty amazing. And that there's only one of us. There's only going to be one Hugo Torres ever. There could be people with your name, but there'll only be you. And that is really intriguing to me and interesting. And had it been 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, I never would have even connected with you or spoke with you or had this ability to have some kind of, like you said earlier, some kindred spirit or some connection that I think we all, that's the human thing that you said earlier. We're all so similar. We all want the same things, really, in the deep down big of it. You know, the best for our family. We want the happiness and peace, you know. I think is people want to help other people deep down and be a good person deep down. I think it's just that almost Orwellian world, like you said, people are angry right now. And there's a lot of reasons to be angry, though, because it's a pretty crappy, you know, we're divided, you know, obviously we're 50% of the country feels one way and 50% feels the other way.
I mean, some of us appreciate, you know, the LA football teams. Some people like the Bills. I mean,
yeah, the Bills. Come on, you remember? I love the Bills.
I was just looking through your Instagram as you were talking. Man. So I had to throw that in there. We do. But that's the crazy part is, yes, we are very much divided. But then I ask, are we really? Because when I talk to folks in my little town, and I know that you live in a little small town, or you don't live in a big metropolitan area.
Yeah, very small, like 18,000.
Right. And similar here. Now, you're on the East Coast?
Yes.
New York. Right. I'm on the West Coast. So we're on the opposite ends. But again, my little town, Monrovia, it's a relatively small, all-American city. We have a little bit of everything. And when I go out to the world and I talk to, you know, our townies, for lack of a better term, they fall in the political spectrum all over the place. Yeah. But when I could sit down with, if you didn't know this about me, I tend to lean liberal. But if
you, I do too.
Okay. But I can go out there and talk to somebody that would lean conservative or heavily conservative. And I have coffee with these folks. I do business with these folks. We break bread all the time. And when we really get down to things, there's a lot in common there.
Yeah.
And yes, we disagree, but I have never to this day have gotten to the point where I have stopped talking to somebody. You know, maybe it's me. I pull back. I really don't care to ever lose somebody over politics. I may mute you for a little while, but I don't ever want to get there. But I've come to realize that there's a lot of things that we have in common. I go back to that JFK speech. You know, we all breathe the same air. We all want the best thing for our children. You know, we want to make sure that the next generation is moving forward and that they're doing better than us. I think we all want it. And so a lot of the times we're told that we are very different and we're separated, but I think we're not, we really aren't. It's just that we don't have a lot of really good pathways anymore to have the conversations together.
Right. Yeah, I think that that's important, the dialogue and those conversations. I actually have lost somebody in my life over, and the person that I lost, I kind of look at it now, and I lost them because at the time, I was really, really drunk at the time, and I saw one of his Facebook posts, and it was a step cousin of mine. And so it's somebody who lived right next to me my whole life, like two years younger than me, and he was spouting off some of the most hateful, vile crap that I've ever seen. And so I'm like, you know, I don't even know what made me go on to his post and say, what's wrong with you? Because, hey, that's your right. If you want to be a hate monger, you want to be whatever, that's fine. I shouldn't have fed the troll, but I did. Mm-hmm. And we ended up disconnecting because I'm like, I could not believe that even though he's my step cousin and we don't have blood, we grew up in the same family. We grew up with the same people all around us. And I'm like, how can somebody's view be so skewed and so hate filled and they don't see it? And I just said, I have no more time for this person. And I really haven't lost any sleep over this person that I've now. Every once in a while, though, I feel like as that recovering alcoholic that maybe I need to get a hold of him and make amends and say, hey, you remember that time? So-and-so, you have your right to say whatever you want. And I want to apologize because I was drunk and I this and that. But I'm like, no, because he's still hateful, vile, and it wouldn't do anything but say, I knew I was right.
You know, I'm always a little worried, mindful. I don't know what the right term is about. When you have identified toxicity in a person, in another person, I'm always worried that the onus on making amends is on you.
Right.
Now, maybe, yes, maybe, I don't know the exact interaction, obviously, but perhaps, yes, in a moment of lesser judgment, you reached out and weren't as... You know, they weren't as mindful of your words as you could have been. But at the same time, you've come to identify that this person, this individual is toxic. And you could say, well, I'm going to be the bigger person and I'm going to reach out. But what's the point of reaching out to toxicity? Because that, you know, I don't know that that person would make a change, that it would make a difference. If anything, it would just, again, feed the troll or give them a win that they don't deserve. Right. You know what I mean? So I don't know that it behooves you to reach out. But again, you know, things shift. And it wins. And so it's, sometimes it's interesting when it's family.
Yeah. And I think if it was somebody closer to me and my family, say maybe my brother or sister or an aunt and uncle, it would be different. But this person being, you know, like I said, a step cousin and somebody that I never interacted with anyways, and I might see at a family reunion if he showed up, I really, like I said, I haven't really lost too much sleep about it. Every once in a while, I don't know why I do it because I stopped following my Facebook and I barely use Facebook anymore, but I'm like, I wonder what hate filled spewing crap he's saying today. And then I'll go over and I look and I'm like, why did I just do that? Why did I just do that?
Listen, I don't know if you've come across him. He's a fairly famous comedian. His name is Jim Gaffigan. And
yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he has this one bit about McDonald's and the fact that we all have our McDonald's, and for some people it's trashy magazines, oh, no, for something it's something like that, right? And I know for myself, if I, you know, being honest, that oftentimes I will go and purposely look at what some madman is saying out there, just to try to get a little bit of a rise. Now I would never respond to it because I'll get fired up. But I do not, I never respond or I never put in comments. I always worry about the fact, because I am very public, that I don't want the words that I speak to ever come back and either harm myself or to certainly harm my family, you know? So I talked about that on the podcast, is the fact that before I put anything out into the world, I try to be really mindful that the words that I've chosen are ones that I can stand behind. But I will go to listen, Alex Jones, before he got taken off the YouTube, I would go and listen to what he had to say. And a lot of times I'm like, this guy is bananas. But yeah, there was some form of entertainment. And I always thought of it, well, that's my McDonald's. That's
It's almost like how Howard Stern was. If you've ever seen the Howard Stern movie, it was like his top viewers are people who don't like him because they want to see what he's going to say next.
Exactly. Oh, no, I remember the movie very well. It's one of my favorites, or, you know, it's right up there.
That was a good movie. It really was. And his story is pretty, you know, I had my uncle, I'm getting ready to do a interview with him. He wrote a movie called Camp Colebrook, and it's just been released and everything like that. It's a horror film. And he told me a while ago, I really like your podcast. You need to be more like Howard Stern. And he goes, I'm just kidding. Because I'm like, I could never be. That's not my personality at all.
Well, that, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because when I first started this, and I had a similar journey to yours, where I listen to a lot of podcasts. I find them very entertaining. I enjoy interesting voices. I'm in love with voices. I think that the timbre of you know, certain individuals, I'm just drawn to them. But I listen to a lot of podcasts, and we also do a lot of long drives as a family, you know, family trips and whatnot. And so oftentimes we'll pick shows that we like and we'll have for everybody to listen. Yours is one of them. And we'll go out there, and my wife has always said, well, you know, you have some smarts about you, and you're witty, and you read a lot and you watch a lot of movies. I mean, you have a lot to say, and instead of bothering us here, why don't you go tell other people about it? And so that's kind of how, and you hear that from enough folks that you think, well, okay, well, I'll start putting it together. And I was very shy for a long time. And I always made it sound like, oh, podcasting is too difficult. It takes equipment in a studio, and it's not something for me, until I finally found Anchor. And all of a sudden I could do it right out of my phone. And I'm thinking, why haven't I been doing this prior to that? But my whole point of that, which I think I just lost the thread, we were talking about it earlier. I completely lost the thread of what I was saying. I got so involved on the tangent. Well, it'll come back to me here.
Yeah, it always does. It always does. You know what I think that's called, and I could be wrong. You know how in French, déjà vu, you know how when you have the déjà vu, and I believe, and I'm paraphrasing, I think déjà vu means like, I know you, and so that's like the familiarness. I believe what you're having right now is when you're thinking of something, I believe that's called persia vu, but I could be totally wrong.
Well, you know what? I have a feeling on your next show, you'll go ahead and define it for everybody. That's
I'll do my best. I'll do my best. But that is almost like where you have that, where you know what you want to say, and then it leaves you. And then 10 minutes later, you're like, aha, I remember what I was going to say now.
Well, you know, so we were talking about the, you know, how the journey to the show got started. And I'll just really go quickly through that. And also I've been doing a lot of writing for many, many years. A lot of it, okay. I've had an old blog that I write on occasion, and they're just these little tidbits. And we were talking about Orwellian times, and I was a newspaper person back in college. I wrote for a college newspaper, and my editor always wanted to keep everything concise. I tend to be very flowery in my writing, and when you write for a newspaper, they want it to be just the facts, ma'am. So who, where, when, and why. And so I got used to that style of writing, 600 words, very compact, all the information right from the get-go, because people don't often read the entire article. And I feel that over the years, that has compacted to the point now where we have the clickbait stuff where people will put out an outrageous headline to get on the article, and people will read a paragraph or two and they'll be done with it. And I think that I consider that a problem. I don't know that we're reading long form like we used to, and that's an issue. But knowing that I have an audience, especially on Facebook, because I do still use it to some degree, I felt that whenever I put something out there, I compact it, I shorten it so that people will read it and it will resonate. But there's always a lot more meat that went into that very specific thought. And that is where the show came out of, that I wanted to really flesh out the ideas that were coming out. And, you know, you said a little bit earlier how you would be talking to your wife and a conversation this would be an excellent topic. That happens to me all the time. I go through life and I think of an interaction or something that I read or a feeling that I got, and I think I need to record on that. And so I fight this impulse of constantly being on Anchor because I have so much to say and I want to flesh out more from the posts that I'm sharing online.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was me when I first started. But, you know, on your show, a couple of the things that I've enjoyed, you talked earlier, like how you like my ambient sound and it brings me there. But you've had a lot of imagery in yours as well. I remember you talking one time, it was in one of your first podcasts or one of the beginning ones, about some memories about your father. And I think you were saying something about how the light was reflecting off the mud puddles, and I was there with you. And so you've got a lot of imagery that you're able to share and to convey that feeling where I felt like I was in that rainy parking lot with you.
Well, that's kind of you. And yes, it's one of the things that I've always enjoyed in my writing is trying to be as descriptive as possible, as to paint the best picture that you can with the words that you use. And there's a lot of people that I read. Stephen King is one of them. He wrote a book called, something 1963. The main character goes back in time to try to stop the JFK assassination. And since I'm old things JFK, I love reading about it. I love the history about it. I had to read it, and it's a wonderful book. But the purpose of me saying all of that is that in the novel, and I spoiler alert, in the novel, the main character goes back in time and goes into a store immediately after the moment he stepped through this portal, and he goes into this little coffee shop or malt shop, and he orders a root beer. And Stephen King talks at length about the richness of the flavor of the root beer. And I am not going to try to do a Stephen King here, but he goes into such detail that I was salivating as he was describing it in the book. And he contrasts it with how root beer is now today from a can versus what it was like and how the thickness of it, blah, 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 blah. And I was right there. And I thought, that's what I want my writing to be. I want, if I am feeling the cold, I want people to feel it. If I am feeling the taste, I want people to enjoy it. And I want to do that not just in my writing, but I also want to bring that to the show. Sometimes I fail. A lot of the times I feel like I succeed. But that's the great experiment of all this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's a
prolific. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, writer. He's one of the only writers I've read before where I kind of like had to put the book down because I got scared. Yes. I'm like, yeah, he's good at writing. Definitely. I remember reading Pet Sematary years ago when I was younger. And then when the movie came out, I was like, the book was just 10 times scarier. You know, it was just so scary and creepy. And yeah, he's a good writer. Have you ever read any of the Bachman books?
No, I have not. I have not. And to be honest with you, I haven't read a lot of Stephen King because horror is not my genre. I am definitely, I love biographies. I like to read about very interesting people. I love history books, obviously. And if I'm going to do anything, I'm going to do more of the science fiction. My wife though has read, I think, the majority of all Stephen King's work. But the reason why I picked up, the book that I was describing was because it had to do with JFK. Right. Like I said, I love everything that's Camelot. And also, I've read an entire series on Lyndon Baines Johnson, who I also think is a very interesting character. But no, I have not read the Bachman books. I tried to get through, the Dark Tower series. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I could not. It was very dense, very thick for me. Again, when he goes into it, he goes into it. I mean, talking about history, what section or what do you gravitate towards? Because I know I have my favorites, but I would like to know, like, what eras do you gravitate towards?
For a while, mine was really Shelby Foote is the name of the author. He sadly just passed a couple years ago, but he was a Civil War buff, and he's got some really good books. And being that the Fort Ontario that I was talking about earlier was a Union fort, the British built it actually in 1755, but it was active all the way till 1946. And so the interpretive corps at Fort Ontario is 1868. It's 3 years after the Civil War. The guys are coming back. They've been injured. They can't go back to maybe being a stone cutter or whatever, but they still know how to soldier. So they had to still garrison the fort. There was only like 55 guys at the time. And so that era was something that really interested me. And after that, I was really interested in quite a bit of the French and Indian War, because where I live right here, we were all active during that. The Mohawk Valley isn't far from us. And the fort was used during the French and Indian War. There was a battle there in 1756 and then again in 1759. So French and Indian War, Revolutionary War, and Civil War were my main ones that I was interested in. And then I started getting a little bit into World War I and World War II just because of more information that I needed to talk about at the fort. Because at the time I was doing historical interpreting. So you're suiting up, you're wearing all the gear, you're bringing people around the fort, just like a tour guide, you know? Yeah. So you have to know as much about the fort, all those years of history. But Shelby Foote is a really good author for Civil War type stuff. And that was what was really, because I think to myself, what a sad war that was, you know, brothers fighting brothers and uncles fighting uncles and how divided we are. It reminds me a lot right now how we are in this country.
Oh, yes. I mean, I don't know that I've gone in as depth as you have. I read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about Lincoln, Team of Rivals. I've obviously watched the Civil War by, what's the documentarian that's famous for? I forget what his name is, but I've watched all of that entire series at least twice. I forget what his name is, but I'll think of it eventually. And my favorite president is Lincoln. It always has been, to the point that I have, a book of his quotes. Ken Burns is the name of the.
Thank you.
I've watched that at least twice, and I've enjoyed it. And for me, I gravitate towards the Civil War, World War II. I have been very fascinated by. For a long time, and it wasn't until recently that the World War I has really piqued my interest. And again, a lot of it has to do because of the way that Dan Carlin tells his stories about different wars. And again, he goes off the beaten path. It's not your conventional history, but it's very, very good stuff.
Yeah. I got a little interested. Well, I had to know some information about World War I and World War II since you just brought those up. During the Spanish Influenza, when that was killing so many people right here in the city where I live in the fort, they used mates, which are where the rifle galleries are and where the houses would have been underground. They used that as a makeshift morgue because this city was losing so many people per day and they had no place to put them. So the Spanish Influenza just wiped out so much of the population here and all these young guys are dying. And so, yeah, we're the only place here in America, my little town, that housed Jewish refugees escaping Nazi Germany during World War II. We have a museum called the Safe Haven Museum. There was 980 some odd refugees that stayed for 13 months as guests of the United States under Roosevelt. So it was pretty interesting stuff. But yeah, Lincoln, he was a great president. Wouldn't it be great to have that time machine to go back and listen to him give that Gettysburg Express
address? Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yes, most certainly. Again, Ken Burns, and it's interesting. If you go to the website, he did a documentary, or he was going to work on a documentary about the Gettysburg Address, and he had people from all walks of life, including celebrities, record their version of the Gettysburg Address. And I recorded mine and I sent it in. So if you actually look at that website, I'm in there. I know that I'm wedged in between Uma Thurman and I forget who else it is.
Oprah?
Maybe.
Uma? But, Oprah.
Uma Thurman, yeah, and Oprah. So, but I'm in there, and it's just one of those things where I hear my accent as I speak it, and I always try to downplay my accent, and I think, well, no, that is just who I am. Again, the difference between 35 and being 41 is that when I first recorded that a long time ago, I was very conscious of those sort of things, and now I've come to realize it's just who I am. I can practice certain things, and I can try to be clear and more concise, but there's some things that are just part of, they're just woven into me, and I got to embrace them. There's some loveliness about them. But no, I love those little tidbits. Let me ask you, again, switching gears here, about the other half. So oftentimes, like I said, when it comes to a lot of these topics, whether it's movies, my wife and I don't agree exactly on what kind of movies to see, or books. She is more of her genre is more crime novels and horror, where I am going to be more scientific, more science fiction than action. Or, you know, if Kubrick is a genre, then anything that Kubrick put together. You and your other half, how does she look at the podcast? Like, what does she think of it?
Yeah, she supports me on the podcast. So, she likes it. There's a lot of times where she's encouraging me to go, move forward and do it. You know, you'll be happier when you do it. And we have a lot of, being a couple, we have a lot of similarities, a lot of difference. But when it comes to, like, movie genres and everything, we're pretty much on the same page. So we're lucky there. She gets into those real-life crime dramas as well. Some Investigation Discovery Channel. I call that her porn.
Got it.
But yeah, we're really pretty similar on that. She's really into, like, the healthy mindfulness, yoga lifestyle, and being mindful. We're both, I think, since we've gotten older, trying to just be happy with where we are and what we have, instead of wanting and wishing and just, I don't know. I think that comes with age. You know, you talked earlier about your accent, and I dig accents. I love hearing the different musicality of people's accents. And yeah, I love it. I love accents. I've always been into that. It's different musicality of people's voices.
Yeah, it's you're right. It's musical. We were talking earlier about how technology has changed things, and I'm certainly not one of these people that loves voices run through computers and synthesized voice. I like the old school twanginess of instruments and just raw voices doing what raw voices do, but that's neither here nor there. One of the things that I always wonder and amazes me is that here we are as a species. Been around for tens of thousands of years, and we've evolved through time. But the fact that music still moves us, that we haven't moved beyond that, that we still have this need to produce and to consume music at the levels that we're doing, that to me is amazing. Is the fact that was there at the beginning and continues to be there, and it doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. And if you add voice to that, it's an entirely different, there's an entire spectrum there to enjoy.
Yeah, it's amazing what music can do, and what music, how it can convey a feeling, and how it can invoke emotions or memories almost more than a scent can, or something where you hear a certain song and it can bring you to a different time in your life. Or like with me, if I hear Def Leppard Pour Some Sugar on Me, I'm like, I remember now being in Daytona Beach, MTV just coming out, visiting my biological father, because that's where he lives. And even if I hear that song today, it brings me back to being that 14-year-old boy and that time and that memory. And I think it's amazing how music can do that. It evokes and conveys so many feelings. And it's something that has been around since, like you said, the beginning of man.
Now, you talked a little bit earlier about you and your wife and the fact that you guys have come to a certain degree an understanding, a mutual understanding about just enjoying life for what it is. Is that something recent, or is that something that you've had kind of in place for a while?
In the past 3 years, I would say, because now that I've been sober for about 3 years, it's over 3 years now. My life has changed a lot because of my sobriety. And I'm fortunate because I can be around alcohol. I don't have to hermit myself from it. If my wife wants to drink, she still can, which she doesn't really. But I think that she's 50 now. I'm 48. I'm sober. And it's just kind of like, you know what? We're pretty good right now. We're fine. You know, it's okay. Instead of, we wish we were here, or I wished I did this different, or why didn't I do this? And all those regrets mean nothing. We meditate together. And so we do this mindfulness meditation. And I think that grounds us too, to just be mindful and present in the actual moment. Cause like right now it's 12:29 on a Friday. I'm talking to Hugo, and that's all I have. I don't have 11:30 and I don't have 1:30. I only have 12:30 right now.
And that's wonderful.
I like that idea. And that grounds me a lot, because yes, it's good to have plans and ideas and thoughts and plans for the future. But that's never guaranteed. And I lived my whole life before of, I've got to do this and I got to do this and I got to worry about this and I got to worry about this. And it's like, but for what? For what? I have to plan for it and be prepared, but I can't do anything until that day comes.
Do you mind if I ask you, what was your career prior to, let's say, you know, within the last 4 years?
I was in sales for years. I was in the automotive sales for a small local dealership that was in business since like 1947. And I sold Dodge vehicles, and that was my thing. And I've wore a lot of hats in my life being bipolar. I've lost a lot of jobs. I've had a lot of different jobs. I've made a lot of money, lost a lot of money. My first marriage, when it went all to hell, I was homeless. I was living out of my vehicle. The only thing I got out of the divorce was the Ford Explorer. So everything I had was packed into that, and, you know, living from couch to couch at buddy's places. And at the time, Hugo, I thought I had everything. I was 24 or 25 years old. I knew everything. I had a young child. I had everything figured out. And then all of a sudden it all fell apart to me. And I'm glad all those things happened to me, because it's made me who I am today. It's made me be the father that I can be to my children, because I've been through so much shit that I can explain to my children so many things, because I have, like I said, wore so many hats in my life. From not being able to keep jobs and stuff like that. Sometimes I'll keep a job for 3 years, 4 years, be very successful, and then it all falls apart, is how a lot of my life went through my careers.
And to that end, you mentioned that your kids are in their 20s, right?
Yeah, 23, and my stepdaughter's 32. Well, okay. We'll be 32.
So let's go with a 23-year-old. You know the challenges that you went through in those early 20 days, and I don't know how bipolar works exactly, but I don't know if it's something that can be genetically passed on. But do you keep an eye out, or do you monitor? Do you worry about that?
I do, absolutely, because it can be hereditary. My biological father was bipolar, and my mom's father was bipolar. So I got it on both sides from my mother and father. So I often worry about my 23-year-old. My 32-year-old's my stepdaughter.
Sure.
So there's nothing I can do about that. But my 23-year-old, yes, I absolutely try to monitor it. And when she was like 18, that's when usually if you're going to have it, those are when the onsets or the little type things might start showing. Younger ages, it's not usually until you're about 18 or so that they can find out. So for years I have, and she, at one time I encouraged her to go see a counselor, and she was for some time. But I'm hoping and thinking that she's going to be okay, because I think that if she was going to have some problems, I would have probably already seen it by now, because mine started even before I was diagnosed in college. And I look back at it now in my college years and I'm like, yeah, that was those were some manic moments. And right. I just was unaware of them. It wasn't until I was 25 or 26 years old that a doctor finally had told me, they were almost still calling it manic depressive at the time, but he was like, you're bipolar. I'm like, what the hell's that? You know? And, once I did some research, found out it was rampant in my family. And so it's something that, it's something I've just been always dealing with.
Now, and I don't know how deep you want to get into this. I just tend to ask questions, but how do you manage? It's obviously being sober is I'm assuming a managing part of it, but how else do you manage, the condition?
Yeah. I take a medicine. It's called Vrylar. It sounds like a gladiator. It sounds like a fighter in this corner. Vrylar.
Yeah.
So I take that, and I also see a doctor. For one time, it was weekly. I would go see a doctor weekly, and now I'm like, once a month, every 3 months or so, I see my doctor almost like for a tune up or a checkup or to get my oil changed. I kind of liken it to. But staying on my medicine, staying consistent, trying to get the proper sleep. But the main thing that's really helped is not self-medicating, not drinking like I was, because I was over 30 pack a day I was drinking.
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I just all of a sudden one day, I don't know what it was, Hugo. I was late at night drinking, beer in my hand. My wife was at work. She's a nurse. And I just all of a sudden I'm looking at this can. I'm like, what the heck am I doing? And I picked up the phone and called for help. And the next day I was on a plane heading to Southern California. And I spent 3 months in rehab there.
Who did you call for help?
I thought I was calling AA, but it ended up being Aid in Recovery. So it was perfect. It was fortuitous that I was that drunk, because had I
been ironically,
AA would have helped me, but Aid in Recovery, this company, was the one that said, hey, we can get you into a spot right now. Why don't you give us your insurance information? Why don't you this, why don't you that? Next thing you know, it started happening really fast. And I started recoiling, going, wait a minute. No. I don't know if I want this. Yes. And I did want it. So when my wife got home, I ended up saying to her, you have to bring me to the airport tomorrow at 5:30 in the morning. And she's like, what? For what? And I'm like, I'm going to rehab. And she just like broke down crying out of happiness, because you got to do it yourself. You know, if a judge was telling me to do it, or a family member was going to tell me to do it, I would have failed. And I'm only in that 3% right now that's made it and stayed sober. And I've been very fortunate that I've been able to do it. And I don't know how I've been able to. And I just kind of, I felt like I, that night when I got ready to call Aid in Recovery, I'm not a spiritual or religious man or anything. I did graduate from a Catholic school, but that's probably because I was going to be kicked out of school. So my parents said, you're going to this private school.
Yes.
And so I know about religion, and I've learned an awful lot about it. And I find it very interesting, and theology and all that stuff's very interesting. And I had, which, like I said, I'm not real spiritual, but I felt like somebody tapped me on my shoulder that night. And I felt like somebody said, what are you doing? You have another option out there. And so it was, if I was a religious man, I would have said that was the hand of God that came down to me that night, you know? And I don't know what it was. I have a cousin who's passed away. And I don't know if it was him reaching out to me, because a lot of times I don't know if I believe that stuff. It's really hard. Some days I'll believe it, then other days I don't know. So I'm basically that true agnostic, you know, where I'm just not sure and I don't have the answers, you know?
I understand. You need to keep an open mind.
Yeah. So I don't know what it was, but I just decided that was enough for me. And I've saved like $35,000 or $36,000 in 3 years from not drinking.
You know, I, like I said, it resonates with me. I have my own challenges with alcohol. And oftentimes I need to hear from other people who have similar struggles to kind of understand my place in it all. And so, no, it's very, very important. And also the fact that your marriage was able, at least the second one, I don't know about the first, but this second marriage, right, was able to survive it.
Yeah, yeah. My wife and I, we've been together now, I think 14, 15 years. And my first marriage was not even a year or so. My first marriage wasn't lost over alcohol, though. It was lost over she couldn't accept the fact that I was bipolar. She didn't believe it. She, even with the doctor, this prominent doctor in our area, who the waiting list to get into this guy, and he's explaining to her, this woman was also in the medical field. She just wouldn't believe it. She wanted answers of why I was acting the way I was acting, why I was doing the things I was doing. And he was saying to her, he doesn't have answers. You know, we can help him. We can't fix him. Oh, so he's going to be like this forever, she was saying. So it just fell apart. And I'm glad it did, though, you know, because I don't know if glad is the right word, but it's made me learn. It made me who I am, you know, today. And I got a great gift out of that marriage because I have a beautiful 23-year-old daughter from that marriage.
And you're both now close, you're civil?
Yeah, we're civil. Now that my daughter is 23 years old, there's no more child support going on. So there's no more interaction that has to happen. And she does her thing out in a little town away from us. And yeah, we would be civil. Absolutely 100% civil if we saw each other. There's no animosity, really. And it's just, we were both young kids. I was too young. You know, I was a young guy and I thought I had all the answers. And I'm still looking for all the answers. You know, I don't have them. I'm just a curious guy.
And your current wife, how, you know, it's to a certain degree unfair for you to speak for her, but, you know, since she's not available, how did she cope with the challenges that you had?
Yeah, I don't know if I could have done it without her, because that's quite an undertaking to say all of a sudden I'm leaving for 3 months and everything at the house, everything has got to be taken care of by you now, you know? And so she stood by me. She's always stood by me. And I know it hasn't been the easiest for her, but I know that she is a lot happier with the sober man that she has. And she keeps me in check with my mental health as well, to remind me, don't forget to take your medicine. Make sure you do this. Make sure you do this. She's a caregiver. Being a nurse anyways, it's in her. She's been a nurse for almost 30 years. So it's in her blood to just kind of be that caring person. And I'm very fortunate to have her. I don't think I could do this by myself without the love of my family. My family's been very supportive through this whole thing with me. So I'm very, very fortunate for that, because a lot of people didn't have that. And a lot of people I went to rehab with already, well, not a lot, but three of them that I know of have already died. And it's just, I was going that route. It was going to kill me.
Yeah, that's the incredible part, is that it can get to that point. And it's one of the things that I'm most mindful of, especially as I start to get into my later years, for lack of a better term. Like I said, I'm 41, but I realize that my body is not as self-correct as quickly as it used to. It takes me longer to recuperate from anything, that including injury, but also you know, a night out overdoing it, I will be laid out for a day and a half, because I just do not have that ability. And I start really wondering about, you know, what is going on in my insides, and am I making permanent damage, which later, let's say that I, you know, hopefully get to 60, 70 and 80, how will the repercussions of the actions that I've taken over the course of the last 20 years, how will that start impacting organs? And yeah, when you get close, when you start looking at mortality, your own, you start making decisions of like, is this my path, or do I need to start making changes? And that's where I think it's important to have voices that you can go to that are not necessarily, I guess I'll put it this way, I am not an AA kind of person. I just don't, or maybe I could, I don't know. I've never tried. But I know that, again, I have a spouse that's mindful and looks after me. I'm okay being vulnerable with her and sharing with her my challenges and triggers that I may have. And also the fact that I do have little ones and they're starting to get their cues. Well, they do get their cues from me. And I have always told them that dad's fallible, that I will make mistakes. But, you know, again, it's a matter of making daily choices.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned AA just briefly. When I was in rehab for 3 months, AA was a must. That was the, you had to do it. You know what I mean? That was part, you'd go to group all day and then you'd get home and the group home. And then you would go to an AA meeting. And I really got a lot out of them when I was in California. And I picked up a sponsor who was a Californian, and he was a younger guy, and he was just totally head to toe tatted, you know, on his heads and everything. He was just, we looked like freaking frats, the two of us, but his name was Patrick. And so it was Patrick Squared, the two of us. And he just helped me so much. And when I got home, I was looking so forward to doing the AA meetings here in my hometown. And it was nothing at all like the meetings that I was getting in California. So I don't go to AA at all anymore, because these little 18,000 in my hometown, going up in this little depressing room, and hearing all these grumpy bastards just bitch and say, oh, you shouldn't even talk until you have a year of sobriety. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. There's no hierarchy here in AA. You know, let's not compare my diseases different. You know, so I tried. I really did. And so now it's more just mindfulness, meditation, being mindful, and just I having the support from my family. But I don't do AA anymore either. It was very, almost had a religious feel to me, which, like, I have no problem with religion, and people that have faith, I really admire that.
Same here.
Yeah, I admire somebody that can have faith and know, and in that, in their mind, say, I know that there's a Lord, and I know there's a God, and I'm like, wow, I wish in a way I could have that, because I don't know, you know. And so I kind of got that feeling a little bit sometimes from AA, that it had that. Just a little bit, you know, but nothing to where it pushed me away. It was the people that was pushing me away here in my hometown that were just too grumpy and too gloomy. And I didn't want to be a part of that anymore. So I do it on my own now. There is an app I follow, though. It's called Sober Grid, and it's all a sober community. And I've been a member of that for 3 years now.
GRID, Sober Grid?
Yep. Sober Grid is the name of it. And in there, you can put in your date of sobriety, approximately how much money you spent a week, and about how much time you spent drinking. I didn't put my time in there, how much, but I put the money-wise, and it does the math for you. That's how I know that I've saved almost $36,000 from not drinking.
Well, that's almost half of being able to buy one of those new Dodge Chargers.
Yeah, well, I'd rather have a Tesla.
Well, yeah. No, the reason why I bring up the Charger is because I had one of those about 12 years ago when the Chargers first came out. And gosh, did I love that car.
Yeah, oh my God, they were a great car. Do you remember the Magnum?
Yes, I do.
Here in New York, at one time when that first came out, our New York State Troopers, that was going to be their car. But once they tested it and did all their stuff, they did not like it. It was hard to see out the back of that car.
Yeah.
It really was. I just, not to jump topic, but I just pulled up Sober Grid while I was talking to you. $34,229 saved. I've been 1,198 days sober. That's 3 years, 3 months, and 10 days.
That is amazing, Patrick.
So it's kind of nice, I guess. It checks, keeps me in place. I can look at it and say, okay, that's where I'm at today.
You know, with that, I think that, and if it's okay with you, I'd like to end it here. I think that we have a lot more to talk about.
Yeah, and
would love to do it again, if you're, you know, kind enough to want to do it, because I've certainly learned a ton from you, and I'll continue to learn, because certainly we live on a planet, I think, is a very important component of my everyday health. For lack of better terms. So, Patrick, maybe in these last couple of minutes, maybe you can tell us a little about where people can find you. Any last parting thoughts that you have?
Sure. Thank you for you also taking the time, you know, and it's early there for you. So thank you. And I really got a lot out of this. I enjoyed it. I guess the easiest way to find me is my website. And from my website, you can find my Instagram, my Gmail, and all that. My website is WLOAP.com.
We live on a planet.
Yeah, it's just abbreviated,
Right. And then people can go there to find you. And you're also on Instagram. I know you're on Twitter, and you said a little bit on Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah. And right from that WLOAP.com, I have a contact page. And so all you can do is push it and it will bring you right to my Instagram. It will bring you to my Twitter, bring you to my Facebook page. And my Facebook page is We Live on a Planet as well.
Well, I've had a fantastic time too. Talking to you, and we will do it again. I promise you that. Kindred spirit, and I'm so appreciative. Thank you very much, Patrick. We Live on a Planet. Check it out. We'll talk soon.
Take care.